Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel for this Tuesday, the 28th of July. Very nice to have you with us, and we will invite you to join our conversation. All you have to do is go to roundtable@wamc.org. Before I do that, let me introduce our panel to you. We have directly across from me, WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. The worst mistake that mankind ever made was to get up from walking on all fours to 2 feet.
Ooh.
Because that's when backaches began.
And I assume you're suffering from that as we speak.
One thing got cleared up by a marvelous surgeon years ago. But now I have what everybody else has.
So are you saying that maybe you should go back to all fours?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I watched our little Noah, our grandson, go from all fours to 2 feet. Became much more aggressive then.
and potential future backaches.
Let me also introduce Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, who is with us for his normal Tuesday duty, but was here yesterday and will be here most of the week, so we're delighted to have him.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. We also welcome Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld, who will be making several appearances this week, and we couldn't be more than a little happy about that. Good morning, Ira.
Good morning. Thank you. This is, we call, as Marty Feldman would say, Abby Normal.
That's right, Abby Normal. It's very nice. So, speaking of Abby Normal, we're in our new studio. We're in the new temporary studio. This is temporary because we're redoing the control room and what we refer to as Studio A.
Yeah. It's
so
nice.
Where we broadcast from this morning is the same place that we broadcast the fun drives from, and but we have this very cool. Pat Cooney and his crew did this amazing job of making this room cozy. And there's all
not
these
echoey.
Not echoey, and have put all of this these partitions up with foam and sound stuff.
Will it make us sound smarter?
Right. Yes, of course.
Only.
Which is the only thing that's really important.
And perhaps the best attribute to the studio is that it's closer to the John.
Ooh.
So
there. You know it is. Yeah. Several fewer left turns.
A few of us that are of that age.
It's very, very nice. So good morning and welcome. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Let us get started with the news for the day. We have a lot of interesting stuff to talk about, so we look forward to going through all of this with you, and do hope that you will join us for the discussion. Let me begin with this story, which I think is pretty interesting, and that is the fact that Boston dropped their Olympic bid. We heard about this yesterday afternoon. What's today? Today is Tuesday. I think you were talking to
Richie Neal
about this very subject,
yeah.
And the concern about Western
Massachusetts
and what they were going to get out of it, and also just this idea of taxpayer money. And the original quote being, well, taxpayer money will not be included in this. And then, the Olympic bid was terminated, and I think it was a little bit of a surprise, which I guess was also not that much of a surprise if you look at the fact that nobody seemed to really like the idea. There was deep skepticism. There weren't many people on the bandwagon to do this.
El Stinko.
So deep skepticism about whether taxpayers would be stuck footing the bill for the Olympics has doomed Boston's bid to host the 2024 Summer Games and raised questions about whether any other major American city might be willing to take on the risk.
Massachusetts, of course, is a very smart state. We know that. You know, Harvard, MIT, Berkshire Community College. It's really terrific from one end to the other, and people don't get fooled, for them to say again and again there'll be no taxpayer money involved, and gave way to the Boston mayor saying, we're not gonna pick up the tab after this is done. I refused to sign that piece of paper, and that was the end of it, because we were being, in my estimation, we were being bamboozled because, of course, there's always money in the end that was not anticipated.
Without any direct knowledge, I just ask the panel, has there been a city who has done well in this deal?
I don't know specifically, but I know increasing numbers of cities like Boston are staying away from these kinds of extravaganzas. The World Cup is another one that comes to mind because it involves building stadiums and arenas, and it's been shown across the world examples that a lot of them become white elephants. Boston was really dodged a bullet here. I'm glad the mayor took a stance against it. Most of the people, according to surveys, didn't want the Olympics in Boston. I'm not quite sure where the movement began. To your question, does anybody want it? Los Angeles still has facilities. They've hosted two Summer Olympics, so that's a possibility. But
yeah, let them have it.
Yeah, but they can. It's more easily absorbed, believe it or not. Even despite all the horrific traffic problems that Los Angeles has,
sure,
it's more spread out. I mean, can you? We've all been to Boston. We've all tried to. We love Boston. I think it's universal in
yes.
this room. But yeah. it's incredibly difficult to navigate the streets. The T is ancient. I don't know whether they propose to upgrade the T. So mass transit is not great, and Boston doesn't need it. It's a world-class city without having to be, quote, put on the map by the Olympics.
And Ira, Richie Neal used two words which strike fear into the hearts of any person in Massachusetts: big dig.
Right. For those who don't know, it was how long did it take? Decades to build this tunnel.
And the cost overruns were frightening.
Yeah. Well, he used a term in your interview yesterday. Yeah. Was it supposed to be $7 million and turned out to be like 40 or something?
It was huge.
It was unbelievable.
By the way, it's one of the reasons why the announcement yesterday about the rebuilding of LaGuardia Airport for, I think they said, about $8 billion. We'll see
yes.
how close to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yes, and I mean billion, not million, by the way.
Well, the luster certainly has worn off being an Olympic host city. I think it used to be portrayed as a way to upgrade the city's image, upgrade the infrastructure, and after the Olympics, you have this positive public perception of your community, and you have these great facilities that can become college dorms and stadiums and public venues that will continue to attract people. And I don't think that's really rang true for a long time.
Doesn't quite work out.
No,
you know,
doesn't.
Every time you go by the Grand Central Parkway, you see the stuff from the World's Fair still rotting.
Well, there is a movement to restore the Unisphere in the New York State Pavilion, which I think is the only thing that are left.
They're really left, yeah. I was in Salt Lake City, Utah, not too long ago, and that's just sad. You see where, and this is the Winter Games, not the Summer Games, but it is the stuff is there, but there's just not the people to be able to support it and to give it the oomph that it needs to keep that that large of an infrastructure going and humming.
Sure.
and
Did you see that only two cities are in contention for the 2022 Winter Olympics? Or 2018? I've lost track of which year it is.
Just not as sought after as it once was for any number of reasons, primarily economic. I happen to think that network television in this country has spoiled the Olympics for me. I think it's become too jingoistic. I mean, there is always going to be an element of us versus them. But the way NBC has packaged this Olympics over the last, I don't know how many Olympics. And
medal count.
Well, the medal count's always going to be there. But there is a sense when you watch NBC's coverage of the Olympics that the only athletes in the Olympics are Americans. And they're presuming that the only people that the viewers are interested in are Americans. So if you have a sport in which it's not a sport that the United States has good athletes, you may get no coverage of it. I don't like the cross promotion. I mean, it's just modern day TV reality show programming. So I've lost my I yearn for the days of the black and white Olympics on ABC with Jim McKay.
You came up via the sports.
I did.
You're out, and if you say this, Ira, I'm with you. I just had one other idea. I have an idea about who might want this.
In this country?
Might need it. No, No, internationally. The Greeks.
Oh, the Greeks. Well, there's a...
They don't have $1.25, of course.
Well, but there's a sense that since the modern Olympics were born in Greece, that's where the permanent... It should be there all the time.
That's right. Yeah. There was talk, and I haven't heard that talk in years, but there was talk about establishing some permanent sites where people would return every 4 years, mm-hmm. or maybe every other Olympics would be at these permanent sites.
I like
sites.
That idea.
Yeah, I mean,
too.
It makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. It sure does.
Make it so.
By the way, I just want to, because I was fumbling with the numbers, but the estimated cost for the Big Dig was $2.8 billion. The project was completed in December of 2007 at nearly $15 billion.
Yeah. So. And by the way, I live in Great Barrington, of course, we all paid for that. They might argue with you that you didn't pay for it because, you know, but what happened was there was no other money available for anything else. So that infrastructure and everything else began to crumble and began to look not so hot. So, yes, the Big Dig did hurt everybody in Massachusetts.
But you could make the case, I would imagine, that something like the Big Dig or something like the renovation of LaGuardia Airport at what will be an exorbitant cost are necessary. The Olympics is not a necessary expenditure of federal or private funds, and I think people in this country are increasingly coming to that conclusion.
But Ira, don't you think when they tell you, what was it, Joe, $2.5 million, yeah. $1 billion, whatever.
Originally. Billion, yeah.
That they don't, I mean, are they lying? Lying means you purposefully tell facts that turn out not to be so.
Well, here in Albany, the Empire State Plaza that Governor Rockefeller and Mayor Corning brokered was supposed to cost $500 million, and it cost over $2 billion, you know, during the 60s. And, you know, factor in inflation, and it's the same kind of ratio.
What's the current status of the Tappan Zee Bridge?
The Tappan Zee Bridge is going to cost somewhere in the $4 to $6 billion range. I guess five is the number that's common. And the financing is not in place yet. Mm-hmm. The building is well underway. If you've been down that way, you can see there's no turning back. But the
is that the Cuomo Bridge?
It is the project that the governor of New York is proudly boasting that he is completing, that his predecessors were unable to do.
Now, but all sarcasm aside, are we disagreeing that there is a need to do this project?
No.
Tappan Zee Bridge? Yeah. Well, there's a new book out by a professor in New Jersey where he says that it was never intended to be a 50-year bridge, and that was a fallacy. It was no bridge. You don't build a bridge for that short a period of time. They just let it lag, and they could have restored it, and it would have been functional. But that's a debate that's moot.
So what about LaGuardia, that third world nation, as our vice president put it, that is known as LaGuardia?
You know, yesterday I had very good things to say about Joe Biden. Remember that?
Yes.
I take it back.
You wanted him to be president yesterday.
Yeah,
what happened?
Well, I take it back. Well, he said Governor Cuomo was the best governor in the country.
Well, Joe Biden likes to speak in hyperbole.
Yeah, doesn't he say that to every governor that he has his hand around at that particular moment?
Well, I flew out of LaGuardia this past winter, and it was the first time I had flown out of LaGuardia literally in decades, I think since the 1970. And I don't know what made me go there, because I could have gotten a comparable flight out of JFK, and it was horrible. I mean, it just...
Was it a large plane or a smaller plane?
It was not the big one. It was not a puddle jumper, but but it was like going into... I was going to use a brand name, but I won't, but it was like going into a bus station, and it was crowded, and the gates were crowded.
But think about this. Taxi fares. You go to JFK from Manhattan. You're gonna have to take out a second mortgage.
Yeah. You can get by for $50. That's most big cities. When I was in New Orleans, it was $40 or $50 bucks.
Yeah,
but
if you go to LaGuardia, we got there one day and it turned out that the flight had been canceled, and we got put on a later flight, and we were able to, you know, just a hop and a skip into Manhattan and back again.
Right.
It is in a good location in that regard, except you can't get there by public transit, I mean by the subway.
Not the subway, bus you can.
Yeah, there's one of the promises is that they will link there'll be a train that will go through Queens and take you over to Jamaica
Just
Station.
Just like the Second Avenue subway.
Yeah.
Well,
I think that
this country and this state have for too long let infrastructure issues linger for fear of getting these big price tags. And ultimately, these things are going to have to be done. And what they've wound up being delayed is costing them more now.
Well, and you mentioned the T in Boston.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a perfect example, which we saw
just recently.
Over the winter yeah. with the problems that they had with it. We're going to take a break. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say Charlie's still on the MTA.
We're going to take a break. We're going to come right back. Alan's going to read a few letters, and then we'll go to the BBC News. Where are we calling the studio? Is this now Studio A? Is this still Studio A?
How about Studio X?
Yeah, Studio X, Studio Fund. I don't know. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel for this Tuesday, the 28th of July. Alan Shartok, Mike Spain, Ira Fussfeld, I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your comments, Roundtable at WAMC.org. We have many other stories to talk about, and we will get to your other letters in just a moment. Let us talk about We've heard from the public editor of the New York Times, the Public Editor's Journal, and we were saying yesterday about the Hillary Rodham Clinton email story that seemed to be corrected frequently, actually, during the Times exclusive story that appeared high on the homepage and the mobile app late Thursday and on Friday, and then was displayed with a three-column headline on the front page in Friday's paper. The headline to the explanation now is a Clinton story fraught with inaccuracies, how it happened, and what next, and it's by Margaret Sullivan. And they say that it's hard to imagine a much more significant political story at this moment, given that Hillary Rodham Clinton is the leading candidate for the Democratic nomination for president. A criminal investigation of Hillary Rodham Clinton by the Justice Department was being sought by two federal inspectors general over her email practices while Secretary of State. That was the story that Margaret Sullivan said certainly seemed like a blockbuster. But aspects of it began to unravel soon after it first went online. The first major change was this. It wasn't really Mrs. Clinton directly who was the focus of the request for an investigation. It was more general, whether government information was handled improperly in connection with her use of a personal email account. Much later, the Times backed off the startling characterization of a criminal inquiry, instead calling it something far tamer sounding. It was a security referral.
Well, the Times, I think, is dedicated to playing it fair, in quotes. And that means that they want, if Hillary Clinton, who is clearly going to be endorsed by the Times if she's the candidate, gets herself into trouble, they're going to be the first people to say it. The problem, of course, is that, there's being first and right and being first and wrong.
Well, it's just yes, that's number one. They seem to have rushed to print something that was not nailed down. They also, I believe, the public editor reports that the Times relied on sources who had heretofore been accurate sources. Parentheses, mine, unnamed sources, which is just something that most newspapers are trying to get away from, using anonymous sources.
Really? Because I see this guy in a Post, it's always unnamed sources. I don't know.
Well, I said most newspapers, and the Post is a tabloid that goes by its own rules. But the other thing is, when they began backing away from the original story and making corrections and reposting the story as they updated it, they were not making it entirely clear or transparent that errors had been made.
They were covering their behinds.
Yeah,
you mean?
And it just, for me, who still has a romantic notion of the New York Times being the greatest newspaper in the world, and I still do think it is,
yep,
it's disappointing to me when you see these kinds of transgressions that you might more likely see on a smaller newspaper or a newspaper whose standards are not as high.
And not to marginalize the actual troubles here to any extent, But it seems that one of the things that the public editor is really making a case for, and almost the apology comes in the little explanation to the readers along the way, yeah. that these changes were made and
they were subtle.
And they were subtle, and they weren't saying, oh, by the way, this is different than what you may have read an hour ago.
Right. It wasn't portrayed as a major shift in how the story was presented. You know, you have to remember that Margaret Sullivan, I think it's the fourth or fifth public editor at the New York Times. The position was established after the Jason Blair scandal. He was a reporter who turned out was
making it up,
basically, yeah. And plagiarizing, et cetera. And after that horrible scandal, they did an overhaul of their entire operation. And the public editor really is outside of the newsroom and has access to interview the editors and the reporters and kind of be there for the public. And she's finding fault with the way that the Times did, as Ira said, you know, relied on people who were usually correct, and they jumped to the conclusion and misreported something. But the real criticism is how subtly they kind of changed the story rather than come out and say, this is a major change, we had it wrong.
Rather than take the rap on the knuckles they deserved.
Which is what they're getting now, isn't it?
The other thing that's interesting is the Times has led the way on reporting this email business, and they were right. among they were the first ones who started reporting in depth about this, and so they own this story in many respects. Uh-huh. But what I find interesting about it is the criticism of the Times in general as being pro-Hillary and anti. You know, the Times bias here is not for or against Hillary. It's for or against a good news story, and they recognize it. As you point out, it's very likely that the Times will endorse Hillary if she's the nominee. But as we have been reminding Donald Trump vis-a-vis the Des Moines Register business, the editorial page is different than the news pages. And so if the news pages uncover something that might be described as a scandal, the editorial page couldn't either weigh it as not a scandal or whatever they want to decide on it. But I just think the Times deserves credit for trying to be aggressive about Hillary despite what they might feel about her politically.
Well, Ira, you sat there all those years as the editor of that paper.
Yeah.
And you know that you cautioned people who came and said, look, boss, here's a great story. Let's go with it. Let's run with it. Let's run with it. And it was your job, right, to sort of stay close and to say, no, you haven't got it all yet. You haven't got it all yet. You need this. You need that.
Right.
That wasn't done there. But I loved what you just said about ownership of a story. So the Times owned the story. And then the question becomes, if you own a story, are you more likely to proceed? Because I remember that incident in All the President's Men, when they made one little screw up.
The grand jury, they reported what the grand jury, somebody had testified, Hugh Sloan had testified before a grand jury, when in fact he actually didn't say what Woodward and Bernstein reported that he said. And it was a misunderstanding as they were interviewing him, and he had confirmed one thing, but they thought he confirmed something else, and it was a big embarrassment and set the story back for a while.
Yeah, it screwed them up.
Yeah.
I think that's right. But I liked what Ira said about ownership of a story, because I think people who are consumers of news products don't quite understand how all of that works.
Well, they were the ones, to my memory, that first reported the problem and have been three or four steps ahead of everybody else. And that's the way I define ownership. And so they're continuing on the story. Others have not, to my knowledge, gone ahead of them. And what hurts them now is the way this story was handled and the corrections. You know, I had a person who used to work for me who always used to say, there's a street in Kingston called Washington Avenue.
Right.
And all you do, if you could write a Pulitzer Prize winning story, if you call it Washington Street and not Washington Avenue, it will screw up the whole story.
Credibility.
If you can't get something like this right, then it throws in doubt everything else you've written.
Right. Well, so next week, if they get an extraordinary story relating to Hillary Clinton and her State Department emails, and they have it from reliable sources, they double-checked everything, they'll be a little hesitant to kind of boast about it this time because they'll know that the public will look at it.
The public is now not going to look at it as black and white. They're going to say, wait a minute, they screwed this one up. But who knows? How do we know this one's right?
You know, people are strange. As you're Washington Avenue, think yes. We hear regularly from a few people who don't like the way we either pronounce Iran or Iran or Iraq.
Iraq. I mean,
and this becomes a passion with them. So I wouldn't worry about the Washington Avenue thing too much.
I think that's a major thing. If you're a local newspaper and you can't get the name of one of your major thoroughfares right, that's going to put everything else you write in doubt.
I stand corrected.
You were a support hose. That's what that's what Steve Allen used to say.
Let's try for one more story before we go to a break. President Obama was in Ethiopia yesterday, sharply criticized Republican 2016 presidential candidates Monday for engaging in inflammatory remarks. He made several comments, but the one was really focused on the comment by former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, who is seeking the presidency for the second time, who made a comment regarding the recent deal with Iran, saying that it was so flawed it will take the Israelis and march them to the door of the oven. Obama talked about what he said was the poor state of political discourse in the United States, saying, quote, the particular comments of Mr. Huckabee are just part of a general pattern that would be considered ridiculous if it wasn't so sad.
And so offensive. I mean, to the oven. We know what that means. Right. And it's really... These people know that they have to out-Trump Trump. That's what this is all about.
And we're talking about it right now. So I guess Huckabee got his attention that he was
absolutely
trying to get.
He's been on the Today Show this morning.
Talking about Huckabee.
Right.
Till today.
But sure. let me just throw out a devil's advocate question, as I am wont to do. Huckabee will point out that the Iranians have threatened to annihilate Israel and have threatened another Holocaust.
Yeah.
That said, is his use of that phrase inaccurate? As it describes what he believes Iran's intentions are vis-a-vis Israel? Or do we say that the imagery that he used here is so visceral and so offensive that he could have and should have said it a different way, but didn't, as you then point out, because he had to get attention by out-Trumping Trump?
Well, you know, Ira, it offends me, I'll be honest with you. I'm Jewish. I have real feelings for the state of Israel. I'm offended by it. It's not that we don't know that there are certain Arab states that have said and jihadists that have said, let's push Israel into the sea, which means you have a point. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it is offensive to me when anybody uses the Holocaust in order to feather their own political nest.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. And I think it points out how the level of discourse, political discourse in this country, not just with Trump, although Trump has elevated it and now Huckabee, it doesn't speak well for politics in this country. It doesn't speak well for the way we view politicians and discuss issues that deserve to be discussed seriously, but with a level of decorum.
We should also not forget that this was the same man who a year ago said that Americans have blood on our hands for failing to criminalize abortion and contended that reproductive freedom is much worse than the Nazi Holocaust. Mm-hmm.
This is Huckabee.
Yes.
Yeah. Using the Holocaust in any kind of rhetorical way is really risky and dangerous, and it really ought to be off limits. And you know, I mean, Robert Kennedy Jr. mistakenly referred to vaccines causing problems for children and causing autism, which he believes is the case, as America's Holocaust, and immediately had to backtrack when he realized how offensive that was.
So, what do you think is going to happen? How do we stop this kind of discourse? If the Republicans, for example, believe the only way they can get attention is to do what Trump is doing. All right, now let's just say for the sake of discussion that they don't succeed in November of 16 and Hillary is elected. Do any of us believe that when President Hillary Clinton will not be the subject of the same kind of vitriol as President Barack Obama? Or no. To put it another way, if the Republicans are successful with this kind of level of discourse and they put in someone as president, whether it's Trump or anybody else, will the Democrats see, well, that worked for them. We're going to have to do the same thing. Are we down a path now that we can't turn back from?
I think there are lessons. You ask a good question, but I think there are lessons to be learned. If somebody uses the Holocaust analogy and is slapped up around the head, for doing it, and really suffers political pain, then they won't do it again. Somebody will think twice before they do it again. But as you suggest, if it works, and if people think, okay, this is the way to go, it'll get worse. We're down the road. Mm-hmm.
Of the people who are near the top of the polls, the only one I believe so far who has maintained a more traditional means of campaigning has been Jeb Bush.
Sure.
The others have resorted to more vitriolic kind of language.
Which means sooner or later you're going to have to end up in an election campaign against the Democrat. Mm-hmm. And I think Jeb Bush is their best candidate, really, because I think what he does is he brings a moderate middle that the other guys are now getting so far away from that they won't be able to recapture them, although mm-hmm. they'll try.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get to some of your letters, plus we'll get to another topic or two. Roundtable at WAMC.org will return to the Roundtable panel after this short break.
Support comes from the 1850 House and Tavern, Rosendale, New York, a neighborhood tavern with a waterfront deck and a porch on Main Street. Microbrew beers, local spirits, and pizza from their clay oven. The1850House.com. University at Albany offering a weekend MBA program for 22 months, including an international trip. 518-956-8330. And the Sembrick, Bolton Landing, New York, welcoming the Silver Bay Quartet for an afternoon of chamber music on July 29th at 1:30 p.m. Sembrick.org.
Solo, and I've been led here by you. Follow. Should I know now more than before? I know I should just let it go. I have been so out of sorts and solo.
Art Carney, Art Carney.
Here we are, Carney.
we're having a good show here. Sorry,
you're wondering what we're talking about. Well, we're talking about who the guests were on the Dinah Shore show.
You know that Ira must be in town.
an absolute delight. Let's go to some letters, Alan, and then we'll go to our last topic.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Washington Avenue at Ira. Washington Avenue is no longer a major thoroughfare and is essentially unusable as even a road. And
yes, that's because it's had about 5 years of sinkhole problems that are finally, we believe, going to be fixed, but absolutely correct.
Okay, wow, says Robert. You guys are really bending over backwards to absolve the Times for very serious errors that none of the paper's executives have apologized for or even openly acknowledged. I'm a big fan of the Times, but this isn't a story.
I'm not sure we absolved them.
No, and I think they may not have apologized so profoundly, but they have acknowledged they made some pretty big mistakes.
Yeah, and Dean Baquette in that editor's column, yes. Also, he's the top editor of the Times, acknowledged those mistakes.
Okay, so, and Jorley says, I don't think Huckabee is trying to be Trump. He's being himself. He's always said ridiculous things. Okay, that's what he said. And let's see. Here is a revolutionary thought. Instead of one city bidding for the Olympics alone, how about two or three or more cities joining forces? I'd love to see New York City teamed up with some other smaller cities around the tri-state area to collectively make a bid to share hosting the Olympic Games. How about that idea?
Maybe Peekskill or something.
How about it?
I thought New York expressed interest some years ago, and it just sort of went away.
During the Pataki administration.
Yeah.
You can't even move in New York now, so, you know.
I mean, the question you have, I would have, if a city is considering hosting the Olympics, is what do they expect to get out of it? If they think they're going to make money, then they're probably wrong. And if they think they need notoriety, well, what kind of more notoriety does New York City or Boston need?
Sure. And Michael says, is Alan in the studio? His mic sounds different today.
Well, we're using different mics, so.
No, but our crack engineering department would never do that to me. I don't think our crack.
Maybe he's referring to Mike Spain.
Okay, and so Tom, who often writes on this subject, I know this studio is temporary, but it's nice being able to see everyone, and that's that the sea of mic booms has disappeared. In the new one, right? That'll be the case. You'll be able to see better without the mic.
Be more TV friendly.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct. And I think that's it, really. Olympic Cannon. Hello, panel. In my opinion, the Olympics, while touted to have significant benefits to a region, have proven themselves to be a financial and environmental strain on various parts of the world. They should be held in a set number of locations. Yeah, I agree with that. That are already developed and able to sustain the athletes and the spectators. And that's from Ilona. And like that. Okay, well, I don't know much more.
Okay, so we'll go to our final story. We have about 5 minutes left. So we'll talk about the shooting, which we spoke about yesterday, in Lafayette, Louisiana. The shooter, this from the Washington Post, an investigation saying that the shooter was able to buy the gun that he used because he was never involuntarily committed. The man who killed two women at a Louisiana movie theater last week was able to buy the firearm legally, despite a judge's order sending him to a psychiatric hospital in 2008, because he was never involuntarily committed for treatment, according to Georgia officials. An involuntary commitment would have banned John Russell Hauser from buying a firearm under the federal gun law that strengthened state reporting requirements after a mass shooting at Virginia Tech in 2007. But Hauser never reached the crucial stage of having a judge rule on his mental competence, a process called adjudication, which is required before someone can involuntarily be committed to a psychiatric facility.
Yeah, just so everybody understands, in the old days, a lot of people went to mental institutions. It was a flourishing system, especially here in it was in New York State anyway. And then what happened was a nationwide thing took place where, you know, you really, really had to be over the traces to get into a mental hospital involuntarily, and you see very little of it now.
I wonder if I understand that we have to look at this and as far as the details, but obviously this is a fairly large. This is something that needs to be corrected. Yes.
Well, one of the problems is that had it been on the record that he was in that mental state, he shouldn't have been issued a license. Now, he did end up buying the gun in a pawn shop, and there was a quick transaction that may not have even properly gone into the database that erroneously didn't carry his mental health history, but it should have, and fixing that database is one thing, and then forcing every place you can buy a gun, whether it's at a gun show or in a pawn shop or whether it's in a reputable dealer, that database has to be checked, will keep guns out of some of the most mentally unstable people. It won't solve all the problems, but it would be a big help, and that system needs to be fixed. I don't know why Congress doesn't want to do that.
Yeah, I think that's right. If people who are against gun control provisions are going to point to this case and this loophole as a proof that gun control provisions don't work. You know, there are loopholes and there are people who are going to fall through the cracks, and hopefully this provision, this loophole will be filled. But, you know, that just, it seems to me to be an anomaly, and tougher provisions are needed, in my view, so that these kinds of cases are, if not eliminated, limited.
And it should be said that we don't know exactly what happened because these are not public records, but he was in the process of being involuntarily committed to a mental institution and something interfered with that. And perhaps he agreed to go into some kind of treatment. And because of that, you know, he wasn't listed on this database.
And I guess it sort of goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, which is it obviously depends on the state of what – and as
exactly.
these
yeah.
and as these become so frequent, these shootings, we learn the consistencies and inconsistencies in the various state laws. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody who wrote to us. We love getting your letters. Roundtable@wamc.org. Mike, we'll see you on Thursday morning. Thank you very much.
Ira,
we'll see you tomorrow morning.
I will be here.
We will see you, Alan, in just a few minutes for Congressional Corner, and then tomorrow as well.
That's right. And somebody wrote in and said that my low end was missing.
I don't know what that means, but I hope
they
you find it.
They were talking about the way I sound.
Oh, okay.
Well, there's a body shot.
Also, I have a backache.
Yeah, no, that's what I thought they were referring to. All right. We'll be back with more Roundtable.